I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Do U.S. automakers have any new ideas about how to make congested, polluted cities more accessible? Can they think beyond 1.8 cars per household? David Burdish of Ford insists they can. He's developing sustainable mobility solutions for the world's megacities, and we'll talk with him about his work today on Smart City. Also with us is Marcia Miro, Acting Director of the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit, which is opening a new exhibition this month about shrinking cities worldwide. We'll talk about the challenges cities face in moving people and managing population shrinkage today on Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. David Burdish is Manager of Social Responsibility and Organizational Learning at Ford Motor Company. He's been at Ford since 1983 and has worked in production, program management, finance, quality, business planning, and organizational learning. David leads the organization in the implementation of the Ford Human Rights Code of Working Conditions, and he's also developing sustainable mobility solutions that should create new opportunities in megacity markets based on megacity needs. David is the president of the Urb Advisory Board at the University of Michigan and adjunct professor there, where he teaches courses on human rights and organizational learning and sustainability. He sits on the board of the Sustainable Mobility and Access and Research Transformation, SMART, at University of Michigan. David, I've just returned from Bangalore, where traffic was horrendous. The pollution irritated the eyes and throat. Roads outside the city were almost impassable. Unfortunately, that's not an unusual situation in developing nations and their megacities. You've been studying the problem. Is there a solution?
Well, I think there's a whole different set of solutions. There's like a more of a portfolio. I do know that the work we're doing at Ford, the megatrends that you're talking about, congestion, the pollution and the health, along with growing social inequality and the flight of movement from people from the rural to the urban sectors, are going to require that people need a whole different set of transportation needs than what we're used to delivering from the automotive industry. So I think the question is, can we deliver the solution in our business? I think there is a solution. I think there's different ways we can go about it. But my biggest concern now is how do we play in these new solutions, because doing business the way we do in United States or Western Europe or Japan isn't going to be the same.
What combination of strategies makes sense to address mobility in megacities?
Well, we need an integrated approach, which requires some systems design, and it would be a combination of mass transport like buses, preferably clean buses like hydrogen, perhaps some trains, but also integrated with car sharing, bicycles, and just walking. The issue then becomes, how do people get the information so they know what's the best way to travel, what's the cheapest way to travel, what's the fastest way to travel, and what's best for the environment, what's the greenest way to travel.
Now, do you picture Ford in the business of clean buses or walking or bicycles?
Well, I think that we definitely could help deliver the technology for different products, you know, a differentiation of vehicles, whether it's an electric rickshaw or a hydrogen bus, or maybe even figuring out the transportation logistics of mass transport. So I believe we can play. I believe that in areas, especially in the emerging economies, we have a good, credible record as a corporate citizen, and the way we respect our local stakeholders and the human rights of the people that we do business with, that we should have some credibility and some reputation where citizens will let us work in these areas. The concerns are, what technologies are out there and do we have access to those technologies? And along with the traditional way that we do marketing, which is sell a car or truck to someone who can afford it it's a lot bit different because in these emerging economies, most people can't afford the products that we make right now. And as you mentioned in the beginning, if the roads are so congested, even if they had a car, they'd have nowhere to drive it anyway.
Right. So you mentioned access to technology as a potential barrier to Ford being in this business. That's interesting to hear you say that. Tell me more.
Well, I think that, you know, it's no secret that we're struggling, and as are the American automotive companies in general. I think that we need to invest a lot of money in different sorts of technologies that go beyond, you know, catalytic converter or internal combustion engines, whether they're run on gas or ethanol or with some sort of hybrids and hydrogen, because I think the needs of the people in the megacities that we're talking about are different. So we have to have access to financial resources, of course, but I think the other thing we need to do is seek out partners. And the partnerships will be the complicated part. But I think we can do that, helped by academics and thought leaders and local non-government organizations in the areas we work with. But it's not going to be easy, especially when, you know, our actions are sort of limited because we're in such financial time burden right now.
Mm-hmm. Do you see markets in megacities and in the developing world? Are they an opportunity for growth? Are they an opportunity for income for Ford?
I believe they are. I just think that we're going to have to do business in a different way. I think the transactions won't be, you know, we sell a car or a truck to an individual. I think there's different sorts of needs that will result from this. It could be people want electric bikes or, you know, a three-wheel type of vehicle. It could be that, you know, people in a rural village, the citizens themselves can't, as individuals, can't buy vehicles, but maybe the community would like to buy a pickup truck to help their farms as a co-op and actually share the car. Or maybe we can provide transportation services and logistics to a megacity like a Bangalore or a Beijing or something like that. I think there's markets. I think there's money to be made. I just think that the transaction and, you know, the economic container or the economic enterprise is going to look a little bit different.
When you talk about a system, a portfolio of solutions for mobility in the developing world and in megacities, you mentioned this important component of how people get information about the best way to travel today, right now, and the cheapest way to travel today, right now. What does that information system look like? Is that is that beyond our reach today, or is it something that, in fact, we could do if we had the will and the financial resources?
I think it's doable with the technology that's out there, because if you think about what technology provides us now with, like the Navistar systems, or, you know, you got logistics systems and the movement of goods, you can track that. So I believe it can be connected. What I don't know about is what are the needs of the individual citizens, because I don't believe anyone's done a real good job outreaching to them. And that's not criticism. It's just that, you know, basically in the transport industry, we depend on the traditional ways to sell cars to dealerships, and we expect the dealers to know their customers. And in mass transport, all of our engagement or all the data or information we get comes from municipalities or the government infrastructure. And what I'm concerned we don't know is we haven't spent time to talk to these people, because generally the citizens of the megacities that we're talking about are very poor, and they get by on $1 or $2 a day. And it's almost like the market's been ignored because they don't have any money, and yet they have real, real needs that we could serve.
Mm-hmm. When you think about this portfolio, where do you think the most leverage is to be gained in terms of improving mobility?
I think in what I'm working on now with the folks from the University of Michigan, I think the leverage is in making the connections and providing goods movement. I don't know if there's a lot of margins in selling individual units to the megacities or buses, but But I do believe there, as a business opportunity, it's we can get into the needs of the citizens and the users of these services, and we could leverage that need, sort of like, you know, the IT people that use Google or customers that use Google or Priceline.com, where they'll say, I need to make a trip, and I'll let all these people make my arrangements, my hotel arrangements and my rent-a-car arrangements for me.
What is the toughest part of the challenge as you see it?
Well, that there's for 100 years for Ford Motor Company and for our competition, we've made a ton of money selling cars and trucks under the present business model. In that, you know, there's population, there's cities, there's urban sprawl, and people need cars and trucks to get to places. And there's a mental model that says, well, if we just do what Henry Ford did in 1903 when he opened up the Rouge and set up the Model T and took the chance to pay people $5 a day, which was an unheard of wage at that time, that we'll pay people enough to afford the products that we buy, and we'll sell these things, and it'll be a cycle of growth and prosperity. What we're finding now in these megacities and the people that live in these megacities is, as the multinationals go into these emerging markets, we're not paying enough people enough to afford the products that we make. And in the area of transport, even if they could afford the products we make, there's no roads or infrastructure to use them, and they don't run clean enough. And they're actually making a problem worse by making the cities more polluted and dirtier. So my biggest challenge is trying to undo the mental models that say that selling a car in India is just the same way we sell one in Indiana. And that's my biggest challenge right now.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is David Burdish. He's manager of social responsibility and organizational learning at Ford Motor Company. David, our friends at SMART at the University of Michigan suggest that we should be less focused on mobility and more focused on accessibility as a goal, that mobility improvements can actually degrade accessibility. Do you agree?
I'm not sure I do quite yet, because I'm thinking based on my own research, and obviously I'm not I have some bias because I've worked for a car company for 23 years. A lot of the cultural phenomenon I'm studying is that people do want their freedom, and they do enjoy being able to get into a car and go wherever they want. So, you know, I've had this conversation, and I think they're wonderful people at SMART, about having accessibility through IT and making choices that way, and they want accessibility to a good quality of life. And I certainly agree with them and understand, but I also think there's something about us that feels a need to move.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, people like to sit in a car or go in some sort of way where they're actually feeling going from one place to another.
Although it's hard to compare the conditions, many Americans are now complaining about congestion. Do megacity strategies for mobility have any application, in your opinion, to the U.S.?
Well, I hope so. I think that if we could influence some of the infrastructure and be part of the what's going on in the emerging markets, that we can move it on here. Because I'll tell you what, you know, I'm a Ford Motor Company employee. I've worked there for 23 years, but I live in Ann Arbor, and there's nothing I'd like more if I could take a train to Dearborn. I'd still own my car, and I'd still drive it on the weekends to go up north or vacations. But there are just certain things that if we could shake and say, you know what, people don't have to drive their car to work, or people can walk to the grocery store once in a while, and wouldn't affect our sales, we could work on that. So that I'm hoping that if anything else, what we can learn is how a car company can help influence the infrastructures of cities, whether they're emerging megacities or fully mature, like a Detroit or a Chicago or a New York, and then look at the habits, the moving and the mobility habits of people, and see how they've changed.
What do you see as the next innovation in passenger transportation in the U.S.?
In the U.S., I think it will be good, clean technology, completely renewable materials, and, you know, the ability to kind of you know, change the skins of your car. Maybe, you know, you have your iPod that you can change the skins on. Maybe you change the skins of your interior. You don't like your dashboard. You want to have a glitzier dashboard. You have soybean seats. You have, you know, corn husk fabrics, that type of thing. I think the cars that will be in the United States will be more renewable, use more recyclables, and it'll be more of like the McDonough cradle-to-cradle design versus the way we have it now. And I imagine that the engines will be of different technologies. The powertrains will be, you know, hydrogen, hybrids, gasoline, alternative fuels, ethanol.
Do you expect the growing trend of pay-for-use of our roads? Do you think that will affect driving habits?
You mean like a congestion tax like they have in London?
Yeah, congestion tax or even just an increasing use of toll roads in the U.S.
I believe there will be that in order to pay for it, and also a way to disincentivize people from driving and pouring carbon into the air. I think that's what will happen. I do know that I can't believe how successful the car sharing here is in Ann Arbor. It's a real cool system. So I think there's a way that could happen where we'll end up selling fleets for car sharing, and I think we'll see people doing a lot more carpooling because the toll booths are going to be so much more expensive.
Do you think when I think about the array of cars at a rental car company and the array of cars in car sharing companies or organizations, they seem completely different. When you go to a rental car company, you know, most everything is kind of mid-size, and you go to the car sharing and they're just sort of hipper, cooler, smaller cars with a few larger cars for that, you know, carting your Costco goods back and forth. Do you think there's a mind shift needed at Ford and other American car companies to get that?
I actually do think there is a mind share that's required. I think that you know, we have to understand the needs of the people that buy it. I know that the companies like Zipcar is a real hip company, and thank goodness they want our hybrid escapes. So I think that they serve a different need. My sister is a University of Michigan employee, and she doesn't own a car, but every time she needs to do something, she goes to the Zipcar here. And what happens is she actually picks a car based on the mood she's in. And versus the rental car fleets at the airports, which, like you said, are basically boring midsize. And I think sometimes that, you know, the way we deal with those rental car companies at airports is we dump that kind of stuff on them to increase our fleet sales for that. So I don't know if there'll be any difference in how we sell, you know, the rental cars at airports, but I do think we have to, you know, look at our designs and our product to appeal to the car sharing crowd.
I want to shift gears a minute, David, and ask you about the other part of your work at Ford. You're leading the company in its implementation of the Ford Human Rights Code of Working Conditions. What does that code include?
Well, it includes the basic seven elements of the International Labor Organization, which is, you know, child labor, forced labor, health and safety in the plant, discrimination, work hours, how much a person can work, the freedom to organize. And then we're updating our code to include sensitivity and diversity of indigenous populations in the different places we work, and then a commitment that our facilities will not do harm to the communities in which we operate.
And the do no harm clause, or the do no harm point of the code, tell me a little more about that.
Well, this actually relates to some of the work we're doing in the megacities. We feel that a precondition to working with the emerging markets, you know, specifically some of the poor people that can't afford our product and look at their transportation needs, is that we need to establish a good reputation in the communities that we operate. So we want to make sure we have a good, solid human rights code that says we take care of the people that work in our supply chain, and we're going to do the best we can do to make sure that the environmental impacts of our plants won't harm the society, the communities in which we operate. So basically what we're saying is by making a commitment to you that we care about how we operate, we care about the people in the community, and that we want to run clean facilities, that you will put your trust in us. And when we experiment with new mobility solutions like the ones we've been talking about, that these people will trust us and look to us to provide them with the services they need.
Do you encourage or require your suppliers to adopt the Human Rights Code?
Our Tier 1 suppliers are, before we source them business to build components for our cars, our vehicles, they do have to have a code or like ours and report that they're respecting that code. Yes, ma'am.
I know monitoring has been a big issue when it comes to labor practices and so forth in developing countries. Do you feel Ford does a certain job of monitoring?
Well, we've experienced the same difficulties that you're referring to, especially in China, where you know if a supplier knows an auditor is coming, they'll clean up their plant for that one day, and then once the auditor leaves, they'll just get back to doing business as usual. So what we've been finding is in our supply base that we're seeing more value in actually working on training and the core competencies of understanding what human rights is about, and using our energy and our time and resources to train and work as in partnership with our suppliers, versus you know taking out the stick and beating them up if they don't pass the audit.
When you think about Ford and its so-called corporate responsibility or corporate social responsibility, how should the company's performance in that area be judged?
Well, I think that you know our first goal obviously is we still have to make money, so we have to serve the customers and serve the investors, but with some profitability. But the way we should be judged is if we have ethical business practices. And, you know, the goal is to leave the world in a better place than when we came into it, or leave the community in a better place when we come into it. So I think the way we hope we're judged is we sell a good product or service. We're ethical when we conduct business. We take care of the people in our plants, the people in our supply chain, and the people in the communities that we operate. And we try to understand the environmental impacts of our product and of our facilities. So I think we should be judged on how we execute financial performance, but also how we do our business and how we take care of each other.
How do you expect the new CEO at Ford to respond to your work in developing countries?
Well, he hasn't had spent a lot of time with us because he's got so many other things he has to deal with right now. But the initial response to our work around human rights and a little bit of the sustainability efforts that we have, he's been very positive. So we're all really excited. We kind of get the best of both worlds because everyone knows that Bill Ford, as our chairman, cares very passionately about this.
David, I appreciate you talking with us on Smart City.
Thanks so much.
David Burdish is Manager of Social Responsibility and Organizational Learning at Ford Motor Company. After a short break, we'll talk with Marsha Miro about the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit and its new exhibition, Shrinking Cities. And we'll talk to Otis White about our growing tendency in America to live among people just like us. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, one of the appeals of cities has always been the diversity of ethnicity, religion, class, and thought. Is that still the case?
Apparently less than it used to be. And this is something that is obvious, but perhaps not apparent to a lot of us. One of the consequences of urban sprawl, of people simply getting more separation from each other, is that they don't know each other as well. And they particularly don't know people who are different from them. If you had moved to a city 100 years ago, you would have been thrown in with a lot of people who had some very strange ideas that you did not hear in your hometown if you lived in a small town the way that you're hearing them now, because you would have gone to the public schools, you would have gone to public places, you would have gone to restaurants and bars and things that would have mixed populations pretty well. Today, the urban experience is a lot more about being around folks who think and act just like you do. So you can live, if you're in a major metropolitan area, you can live in a congressional district that elects nothing but liberal Democrats, or a congressional district that elects nothing but conservative Republicans, and virtually all big metropolitan areas have these places. Now, the interesting thing is we've come up with a word for this now. This is a great academic word, which I'm going to introduce to you today. It's called homophily, and it means birds of a feather like to flock together. That is, that we like to be around folks who are like us. We normally think of this as being sort of racial and ethnic, but it means ideological as well. The result of all of this is... Unfortunately, the role of cities as marketplaces of ideas, where just average people can hear people expressing completely different ideas from the ones that they normally think and thereby learn from it and temper their opinions, is being lost to an extent. And that's a shame. Of course, a part of all this is also the media. With all the new media around, we don't ever have to read an editorial that doesn't agree with our opinion. We don't have to hear anything on the radio that doesn't sort of speak to our interests if we don't want to.
Do you think there's any going back?
No. Well, I was sure it would be nice. There are some intellectually curious people that if given this opportunity, they would do it. Most people are not like this. They really don't want their opinions challenged. But there are people who do, and those are the very best people that a city can attract, the intellectually curious. So one of the things I think cities could do is make those kind of casual connections, safe places for people to talk, more available. But I don't think for the large population that most people seek that.
Well, I think we will be missing something very special in our city should we continue along this track. But like you, I fear that perhaps there is no going home again. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist with Governing Magazine. Marcia Miro is acting director of the Museum of Contemporary Art, Detroit. She previously taught art history at the Center for Creative Studies in Detroit and has numerous books and a film on Cranbrook to her credit. Marcia, what made you decide that there was room on Detroit's cultural scene for a Museum of Contemporary Art?
Well, I think there's a huge gap in our community in the city of Detroit where all these young things that happen, new things that happen, don't have a single place where they can roost, where they can interact and intermix. And since I left the Free Press in 1995, it was something I felt as somebody involved in the art scene was something that was missing, and something that every other major city in the country and many in the world already had and have had for so many years. And all those things kind of played into the decision to pursue this idea.
You mentioned that all the other contemporary art museums that are popping up around the country, and certainly there are many. To what do you attribute that?
Well, contemporary art is the art of our time. It speaks with the voice of the moment. And when you want to know what 18-year-olds are thinking, or artists who are in touch with what's happening in Saigon or what's happening in Africa or in your own backyard, this is what they're doing. They're taking the grist of our lives and turning it into something beautiful, something powerful, something strong, or something ugly that makes us think and feel. And so we needed a place that would reflect that, that would carry that voice for us and broadcast it out into the world. And I believe that's why they're so popular, because in most cities, that is an important component of a cultural life and of a human life.
Is this unusual in history to have whole museums, whole institutions devoted to art being made in the moment, in contemporary times?
Well, it's a phenomenon of art at the art in our age. First of all, museums haven't been around forever either, and the idea of contemporary art is, some people date back to 1960, some people may say 70s, but it's a fairly new idea. So having a museum dedicated to contemporary art is really part of the whole phenomena of the process of art making. And there are whole museums dedicated to Roman art or, you know, Greek art or Egyptian art. And but this is a more universal language, and we're living in a global climate, a global universe. So the language fits.
Well, you've raised two questions for me. One, you talk about living in a global universe. What is it about this art that reflects a global universe?
Well, our first exhibition, which continues through April 29th at the museum, is called Meditations in an Emergency. And the curator, who's from New York, his name is Klaus Curtis, felt that the world at this point is becoming a small village, and that what happens here in Detroit can be broadcast anywhere in so many different ways. And the artists reflect that. For instance, just to give you an example, we have a sculpture machine made by a man named Roxy Payne. And it's a technically driven machine. It runs by computer, but it looks like an old-fashioned assembly line machine of some sort. And you put in plastic pellets, and out comes, out of this feeding tube, out comes sculpture. It makes this sculpture in front of your eyes. And it's all about this idea of technology deciding what's unique versus human beings deciding what's unique. And technology is a factor that is really closing the gap between nations and pulling people together. And so it is about this moment in that way, and also its message about the uniqueness of the human touch versus the machine is very much something that we all think about and know in different ways. So that, to me, is a global issue. Another piece is this kind of shanty town. And it has these wonderful hybrid creatures living in this town. It's by a man named John Polipchuk. And everywhere you go in this world now, people live in shantytowns. And it's just a factor of a low-income world and much more familiar to us. And the creatures in it that he's made are part human in terms of their gesture. They contain different animal features, bird features, and so it's this hybridization that we're experiencing in this global world of ours, where races are no longer exclusive, and dogs are mixed breeds, and on and on and on and on. So, I mean, that's how art really talks about the relationship and the changes that are happening in our world at this moment.
You spoke about contemporary art being a particular type of art, genre of art, that dates to the 60s, maybe the 70s. But all art, when it's made, is itself contemporary. Even though it may be of a different style, it is being made then. I'm wondering if the idea of a museum paying homage to art being made now is an unusual trend in history. How do you sort those issues out in a museum of contemporary art?
Well, I mean, it's a very, those are very good thoughts and very interesting thoughts. Contemporary is also, in this case, a descriptive term, and it's a title that is used in art history. And so that's why I use the term and why the museum is called that. But we're not a collecting institution. we will not own any art, partly for that reason, but partly because the issues with contemporary art are not so much about whether it will endure for 500 years or not, but whether it is about ideas and issues and a use of materials that is interesting for today. And when you have experts, and there are many of them, who seem to know, having studied the history of art, what gives something value, they are able to judge what is being made today that they think will have long-term value. And a museum like the DIA has a completely different take on those things. And that's why both institutions are so important in a culture, in a community. And we have employed experts who have that kind of vision, who know what is happening around the world, have a sense of what is important and what has value, and like any good chief executive, make the right decision in terms of value.
Mm-hmm. The Museum of Contemporary Art in Detroit is located in a former auto dealership. Given Detroit's close association with cars and car culture, did the location have any symbolism for you?
Absolutely. We felt very strongly that we wanted to be part in a piece of Detroit history and to savor it and enjoy it. And the building was an old Dodge dealership. The front room, the major gallery space, still has the old tile from the showroom. And many of the walls are infilled or still have years of patina from the lives that the building has had since it was a Dodge dealership. And we feel that's very important because the industrial history of our city is a beautiful history. And we wanted to become another link in that chain, another layer of history on that history. So when this building became available, it seemed like the perfect choice.
You have an exhibit opening February 2nd called Shrinking Cities. Tell me about that show.
It's a very interesting exhibition, I believe. It was organized by the Cultural Foundation of Germany, and half of the exhibit will be at MOCED, the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit, and the other half will be at Cranbrook Art Museum in Bloomfield Hills. And the thesis of the exhibit is that there are many major urban areas that have lost significant amounts of population over the last 50 years. And they selected five areas, four in Europe, and Detroit is the only one in the United States. And the thesis was to study what caused this kind of depopulation and then ask artists and philosophers and musicians to think about how you can change that, what interventions would help change the way people look at depopulation and perhaps add population. So the study part, which deals with the issues that caused the city of Detroit to shrink, will be at Cranbrook. And at MOCAD, we have all these different installations from both Detroit and the cities in Europe that are part of this group, where people came up with ideas of how to bring population back to the city, or else how to celebrate what the city had become. Not say that there's something wrong because you've lost population, but say that this loss of population enables us to do other things and look at the city in different ways. There's a section about urban farming. There's going to be a group of artists who are using the ghetto palm trees that kind of proliferate around the city but have a very short life. And they've picked them up from the city from all around, and an architect's designed furniture, and there'll be people making furniture out of them. Perhaps that's a new industry for Detroit, but it's also an artist's way of understanding and translating the real world into something that's wonderful and fanciful and possible or impossible. So the show, I think, will stimulate a lot of dialogue about these questions. And we have a very extensive program of lectures and panels and very important thinkers from around the community and outside the community coming to speak, as well as music programs where we're bringing in musicians from the city to celebrate the music tradition, and film, which deals with all this issue, these issues of cities. So it's going to be a very interdisciplinary, wonderful event. And there'll be a bus that will go back and forth between Cranbrook, the suburbs, and the city, the museum, on Saturdays and Sundays, so people can actually physically experience the shifts.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Marcia Miro. She's the acting director of the Museum of Contemporary Art, Detroit. Do you expect the political community in Detroit, the political leadership, to engage with this exhibition, Shrinking Cities, and be part of the conversation you're trying to stimulate?
Well, we do have some people from the City of Detroit Planning Department who will be involved in one of the symposium. We have people from the local universities, U of M, U of D in architecture.
But, University of Michigan, University of Detroit.
Exactly, okay. Sorry. But as with all art, art's about stimulating discussion and thinking. It doesn't necessarily say that this is the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's more reflective and a spur to lots of other thinking, we hope. And if that doesn't happen, we hope people will come and enjoy the experience of understanding what's happened and dreaming about what might happen. One of the things we've done is a publication. We have a journal that we publish at the museum. And this journal for this quarter of the season is called Imaginary Cities. And we've asked important writers and poets and artists from around the world to contribute, as well as children in the local school system, in the Detroit school system, to contribute their idea of what they would do to a place in the city of Detroit, how they would change it, how they would leave it, what they would dream about for that place and in that place. So it's about this kind of poetry, not as much the politics.
Mm-hmm. Is the journal now available?
It will be available at the opening of the show, and then we will have it on our website, which is mochadetroit.org.
You mentioned that you're going to have a bus traveling between the two institutions, between suburb and city, on Saturdays and Sundays during Shrinking Cities exhibition. This exhibit, in part, explores the relationship between cities and their suburbs. What is the relationship between Detroit and its suburbs?
Well, the thesis of the exhibition is that part of the reason for the shrinkage in Detroit was suburbanization, that people moved out of the city into these new towns or smaller, older towns, whatever they may happen to have been. And the metropolitan population of Detroit has swelled where the city population has shrunk. So this is a chance with this bus trip to see how things have changed. When you drive through the city, you'll see many streets where there are a few houses left on the street and the rest of the houses are gone. They've been torn down and they're fields now. And the city is almost becoming more country-like while the suburbs are becoming more urban. So it explores that whole question and it's fascinating.
What effect do you hope the show will have on the city?
I hope it opens a lot of discussions and a lot of thinking processes so that people don't say Detroit is a dying city, but they say Detroit is a city with wonderful opportunities that are just different. The museum is in the heart of the city, and we're having a great time. We have wonderful attendance. People love being in there for our parties, for our music, for all these things. And I believe firmly that the city of Detroit is coming back, and it's becoming more of a center for all these suburban areas, and that people come in from the suburban areas to be in the city, to go to the ball games, to take in the restaurants, the symphony, the opera house, the museums. And so that's very important to us.
Do you think the city of Detroit, or any city, can use its cultural assets to reinvent itself and its economy?
People discuss that. They debate it. I hope it's a possibility for Detroit, but I don't know that anyone knows for certain. They always refer to, experts refer to the Bilbao effect with the Frank Gehry building that was built in Bilbao, Spain, bringing in so many tourists and so much help to the economy. And it's been very important there, but I just think you don't know. You never know. There's too many variables.
You mentioned the Bilbao effect. To what extent do you think iconic architecture makes a difference in the effect that cultural institutions have on a city?
There have been many studies about that issue, and I think it can be very important. There are multiple examples of that making a difference, from Disney Hall in L.A., Bilbao, Cincinnati with its new museum designed by Zaha Hadid, and the Wexner Center, the Peter Eisenman building, which sort of started it in Columbus. And so there are many examples of people traveling for architecture. But there are also examples of people traveling to see a great art show. Many people will go to New York if the MoMA and Met and the Guggenheim happen to have three great art shows. So I think, again, it's just a matter of how those variables happen to be knit together at a particular moment.
We're talking in part here about tourism. If you think about the museum's effect on the city of Detroit and the metropolitan area it anchors, what do you hope the museum's effect on the community will be?
Well, I feel that we'll offer something to our younger population that hasn't really existed in one place before. And that could be very hopeful for the city, because so many young people seem to move away saying it's not just the job, but it's the quality of life. And if you look at Chicago, they have two contemporary museums. And by bringing a lot of the things that the younger population are interested in one place, they can come on a Friday night and hear a great band, a new techno band, a new jazz band, a rock band. That's kind of a counterculture thing. And so we're hoping we'll offer the younger audiences a place to hang out. And we want to collaborate with all these other institutions so that together we can help build an audience and grow the audience that already exists. So that's our dream. That's what we hope, that the boundaries that existed between the city and suburbs will become more and more porous, not just because of us, but because of all of us together. And the cultural center area of Detroit now is a much more stable area than it ever was. You can drive quite a distance along Woodward, which is our main drag, and the cultural institutions are all lining the street leading up to downtown and the stadium. So it's becoming more of a mecca, and when you have it all together, people feel more comfortable. Say, I'll drive in and I get to see three things. And I hope that we just increase the cultural literacy and bring a younger audience to the arts as a result of our activities.
Marcia, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, thank you for talking.
Marcia Miro is Acting Director of the Museum of Contemporary Art, Detroit. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. We've turned the corner on another year, and the W-2s, the 1099s, and other income-related documents have trickled in. They provide the information necessary to determine your net worth. This week, CityView's commentator Walker Smith takes a look at the other side of the proverbial coin.
My grandfather was a family physician. He received his medical degree in 1906 and practiced for over 50 years in a small country village in west central Alabama. When he began his practice, this town was a busy stop on a state highway that brought commercial traffic through the county. One year, though, a flood washed out the bridge to the south, over which this highway crossed into the next county on its way to the biggest city in that part of the state. The bridge was never rebuilt. Commercial traffic was rerouted down another highway, bypassing the small town in which my grandfather practiced medicine. The town never recovered from this blow, but my grandfather never left. He considered leaving, of course, but he felt he was needed where he was, and he preferred the comforts and kinship of that community to the possibility of riches that might await him elsewhere. Times could be hard in that part of Alabama during the first half of the last century. My grandfather struggled as much as anyone. One of my aunts described what it was like in an essay she wrote about her father for an assignment in graduate school. "When Daddy was paid at all," she wrote, "he was paid largely in produce raised on farms. Some of my fondest childhood recollections are the times that my brother and I raced to the front gate to meet Daddy in order to see whether he had brought in, as his fee for the day, a pig, a goat, or another gallon of syrup." My grandfather raised cotton for the cash he needed. He practiced medicine to minister to the health and well-being of those who toiled and dwelled with him in that little town. Whatever their position or status, whatever their race or religion, whatever their ability to pay, my grandfather doctored them all. Now, I don't mean to make my grandfather seem larger than life. Certainly, he would never have thought of himself as anything but knee-deep in the particulars of everyday life. Nor do I mean to suggest that my grandfather was better than other people who have made similar or greater sacrifices out of similar motives. But there is something about his example and the principles that guided his life that resonates more strongly with all of us nowadays. In her essay about him, my aunt wrote, "Daddy never sought to lay up riches. He merely wanted to be independent." I have always regarded this as the best definition of success, financial or otherwise. It is the kind of ambition that puts greed to shame, and that reminds us that selflessness is the only sure path to self-improvement. My grandfather knew that he could stand no taller with more money than he could through more service to his community. He was his own man because he was there for others, not because he was there only for himself. He was rich beyond riches, and what made him so was not what he brought in, but what he gave away. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.